Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Mine does chilled filtered water and chilled sparkling water too. I really am living in the future. For more details, the product and the range, go to cooker.co.uk. And I just want to thank them again from the bottom of my heart for sponsoring this podcast. It really does make a difference, keeps it going. I do thoroughly enjoy doing it. Again, thank you for the feedback I've been getting recently. People telling me they love the podcast. It's always lovely to hear. It means a lot to me. If you want to say anything or recommend any guests, any suggestions are always good. You know, you can go to my Twitter at Tim Lovejoy or email me lovejoyhour@gmail.com. Today's hour, I'm curious about the culture wars, and who better to talk to than John Ronson. He knows all about this stuff. A culture war, by the way, is a cultural conflict between social groups and the struggle for dominance of their values, beliefs, and practices. John is an author, I'm sure you all know. He's also a filmmaker. His works include Them, Adventures of Extremists, The Men Who Stare at Goats, The Psychopath Test, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, which are all of them are great books, love them. He made a great podcast series too called The Butterfly Effect, which is all about the porn industry. If you're not listening to that, I really recommend it. He's got a new podcast out with the BBC at the moment. It's called Things Fell Apart, a series of strange, unexpected human stories from the history of the culture wars. It is very good. I recommend it. I think by the time I'm recording this, there's been three out. And they're all brilliant. Really thoroughly enjoyed them. Oh, yeah. He was also the keyboard player for Frank Sidebottom's band back in the day. I have to say before we start this conversation, I'm a huge John Ronson fan. I suppose what it is in this world of disposable media, John's work is considered and it's smart. It's always presented in an easily accessible format. And he just makes me think. He's great. He makes me think about things and he's discussing stuff that I'm interested in. Anyway, let's meet him. Here's John Ronson. Hey, John, how are you?
Tim, I'm well, thank you. A little groggy, but basically fine.
How's New York? You based there now forever?
Yeah, well, forever, but I don't know. But I've been here for 10 years. And I do love it. I'm coming. I haven't been back to Britain in 3 years, and so I'm coming back in March, and I'm going to do some shows. I think based on Things Fell Apart. I didn't really answer the question. I guess I don't want to say out loud that I'm never moving back, but I might move. Who knows? Who knows? People say, like, lots of emigres have told me that they go back to Britain to die.
Right.
So maybe I'll do that.
Do you find that, or how do you feel you think now? Do you still think like a Brit in America, or have you started thinking like an American in America?
That's a really good question. You know, a little bit of both. I think that I do like the positivity and sort of open considerateness that you get in America and the kind of can-do attitude. A lot of those character traits, which when you live in England, one finds a way to be sniffy about, because we're so used to being pessimistic and adversarial and just glum. But actually, I really like it. Like, I really like it. I really appreciate those character traits. But I also love our British cynicism. And so, yeah, you get the best of it, but you get to experience two different set of personality traits, both of which are good. You don't have to choose one over the other.
Well, I suppose today we're going to talk about the culture wars because of your fantastic new podcast, which I love, by the way. I think it's great. I was just saying in the intro, I'm a massive fan of yours, so I like all your work. And I remember being in hard times in my life and picking up your books, and just because of the way you write them, so they're so easy to read and the contents wonderful, and also you have empathy for everyone, and so that combination really makes it an appealing read, and sort of helped me. I always say you're never lonely if you've got a book, and your books really helped me through some periods where I was trying to get confused, and it was just a lovely distraction, may I say.
Thank you. You know what? I was thinking the other day, like, we just put out episode 3 of Things Fell Apart, which is this really moving story about how a church minister with AIDS, Steve Peters, went on a televangelist's afternoon chat show and the ripples kind of changed the world. And people have been messaging me for, you know, a few days now saying that they were sobbing while listening to the show, going up the M6 and, you know, stopping in their tracks and wiping away tears and stuff. And one of the reasons why people are so moved by the show is because of the sense of connection of two warring factions coming together and finding communication and mutual empathy and kindness. And we're living in a world where the empathy tends to be very selective. People are very empathetic to their own group, but very kind of hateful towards other groups. And I think the fact that people were so moved by episode 3 of Things Fell Apart is testament to the fact that we don't want to live in that world. We want to live in a world where there's peace. We're going through a civil war. We're going through a cold civil war. And people don't want that. The only people who want that are the warriors. Yeah. And the rest of us, we don't want that world. And I think the fact that people were so moved by that episode is evidence of that.
Yeah, I love that episode. And it moved me as well. And for anyone who hasn't listened to it yet, it's basically it's about religion and very strong religion. And this woman decided, and religion at the time hated people with HIV. AIDS, yeah. Yeah. And so they decided that, you know, they were very anti it and that was like the devil. And this one woman decided to embrace someone who had it. And great consequences came from it, I believe.
Yeah, it's a really incredible story. The televangelists, the Christian conservatives in America at the time, hated gay people so much that Jerry Falwell, who was probably the leading Christian evangelist at the time, the story goes, convinced President Reagan to just not say the word AIDS. And he didn't for 4 years. So for 4 years of that epidemic, the president didn't even mention it. And so you had this wonderful televangelist named Tammy Faye Baker, who was very like a kind of Dolly Parton-ish. And she was feeling more and more alienated from her televangelist peers. And so she decided to invite somebody with AIDS onto her show. This was in 1984 when everyone was dying, no one was surviving. And she invited a man called Steve Peters, who just did the most wonderful, between the two of them, they did the most incredible interview. It was so moving. It kind of convinced an awful lot of Pentecostals to support gay rights. Mm. And incredibly, so that's one miracle. And incredibly, not only did Steve Peters do this incredible thing in 1984, he's still alive, and he is probably the oldest living person with full-blown AIDS. By which I mean nobody else who developed full-blown AIDS in 1982 is alive, except for Steve, as far as we know. So two miracles. And I'm not a religious person, but I can't help thinking Steve is such an incredible person. If you hear the episode, you'll see such an incredible person. Were I a religious person, I'd wonder whether God kept him alive to spread this message.
Yeah, religion's really big in America, isn't it? And it's really extreme. Especially
Big and less extreme. I think in the 80s, I think 90% of Christians, 90% of Americans identified as Christian.
Right.
It's really plummeted. I can't remember what the exact figure is, but I think it might be something like 60% or even less now.
Right. Yeah. But it still seems to affect power. Look at Trump. Couldn't wait to quote God. Bush, when he went into the war, said, you know, we're going in God's name. Even Tony Blair did that from our side, yeah, didn't he? And I always think it's strange when the politicians are doing that when we're in a country which is so diverse and split. But what's interesting about you living in America is it seems to be the place which is exporting the culture wars more than anywhere else in the world. It seems to be the epicenter of it.
Yeah, I think so. And it's exported to Britain. I think Britain is probably the other country where people are very riven by the culture wars. Interestingly, in Britain, the war over trans rights is burns much hotter than I think probably anywhere else in the world. The fact that you can barely turn on the radio without hearing people arguing over it in Britain, that's very unusual. It's getting more unusual in America, but it's interesting that trans rights, I have my theories as to why, but it's interesting as to that trans rights burn so hot in Britain, disproportionately to the rest of the world.
Do you want to tell me why, or is it something you're saving for?
Well, it's all going to be in episode 6.
Right, okay.
So maybe I should save it.
Okay, save it then, because I want to listen to it, but yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, what you said, you know what you mentioned about Trump courting Christians and Christians courting Trump too? There was they really had to hold their nose. Like, they knew that so much of Trump's character and personality was just not what they would regard as Christian. So they really had to hold their noses. And the reason why they held their noses was abortion. By now, the Christian right are very galvanized about abortion. And Trump promised and delivered on his promise that he would pack courts with pro-life judges. In episode 1 of Things Fell Apart, I discovered this incredible story about how the Christian right got interested in abortion. And it's just this extraordinary, surprising, unexpected story that you would just never anticipate.
Yeah, and I think towards the end of that one, you say that if you live in Texas now, it's pretty much impossible to get an abortion.
Yeah. The law, it's been tested in various different appeal courts and so on, but essentially, you can't get an abortion now in Texas if you've been pregnant for more than 6 weeks. And of course, most people don't even know they're pregnant at 6 weeks.
Right. Okay. What I love about what you do is, what would you call yourself now, by the way? An anthropologist, a cultural anthropologist? Is that what you are? What do you think?
Yeah, that's what I call myself now. self-loving to call myself a cultural anthropologist. I'm a non-fiction writer. Sometimes I write fiction when it's screenplays, but I'm basically a non-fiction writer. I'm a storyteller. I tell stories. I sit here where I'm sitting right now talking to you for 5 o'clock in the morning, every morning, thinking how to construct the stories in the best possible way.
Yeah, but you're fascinated in human behavior, aren't you?
Yeah, why we behave the way that we do. And I'm interested, I think, in de-demonizing the demons. I always have been. So for instance, Tammy Faye, the star of episode 3, there's a lot of people who hate Tammy Faye because of the bad that televangelism did in America in the 80s, plus the fact that Tammy's husband, Jim, was imprisoned for financial fraud. So there was corruption in that institution. But the way I see it is that, I should be the person who tells different stories. I'm not stopping the demonizing stories from being told, but it's nice to have a sprinkle of just curious, empathetic, humanistic, non-confrontational stories. I'm doing that's probably the last interview for Things Fell Apart on Monday, and it's somebody who I think other people would be confrontational with. And I was thinking about the interview and thinking, oh my God, am I going to have to ask her confrontational questions? And I thought, well, no, I don't. Like, I don't. No one's forcing me to do that. And I just felt a big sigh of relief thinking, no, this can just be a conversation. And who knows what will emerge from it? Maybe unexpected stuff will emerge from this conversation, but I don't have to be confrontational.
John, that is what I love about what you're doing. Because at the moment, we've got a culture where people are going, you didn't ask hard enough questions. Why aren't you going for the jugular? Why? Whereas what you do is you assume that I'm smart enough to be able to read a conversation. You ask the pertinent questions. I'm listening to the answers and I'm making my own mind up. And I can tell that you know what you're talking about because your narration's always very considered and you don't hold back from your views, but it's great that I can actually hear what their point of view is rather than you forcing them to answer a question they clearly don't want to answer just by not go on.
Yes. Well, yeah. The thing that always baffles me about prisons is that, and I've seen this in so many different prison dramas, and I'm sure it's true, not a cliche. You go to prison, you're imprisoned. And then pretty soon after you're in prison, other prisoners yell at you or confront you in some way. And how you respond to being yelled at and confronted determines how well you're going to get on in prison. And I guess in prison, you kind of understand why, though. But why do that on the fucking on the BBC? Why do that on... It's like, why do we think that the way to get to the heart of who somebody truly is by screaming at them and flashing, that's not how I reveal who I truly am. When I'm being shrieked at, I reveal a side of myself, which is a panicked, saying something without thinking side. It's irrational that we think that that's how we get to the heart of who somebody really is, by putting them in an extremely adversarial situation. There's no evidence that that's how we get to who that person really is.
Yeah. And the other thing I think, which you do so well, which is can be lacking sometimes, is what I like to call the boiling water process. It's something that I sort of invented in my mind because I heard it once, a scientist talking about how you have to always take an experiment through to the end. Because if you start boiling water, you watch water, and if it was the first time you'd ever seen water, you'd go, oh, look, it gets hotter, it gets to 10 degrees, then it gets to 20 degrees, it gets to 30 degrees, it gets to 40 degrees. If you stop the experiment there, you would think it goes on to 1,000 degrees. You just think it's going to keep on going up and up. But when it hits 100, it boils and stops. That's the temperature it gets to. It's like the boiling water process. So what you do is you go, okay, right, so let's just say the butterfly effect, or actually the series one of your podcast. How did it happen that the church, the televangelists, started going so anti-abortion? And you track it all the way back to where it actually starts. And it's like, go on.
Well, there's something so nice about ripple effect stories, because what it reminds people is that we're all connected in a way. We're all part of ripples. The reason why I wanted to start telling ripple effect stories was when I was writing So You've Been Publicly Shamed, and I was interviewing a guy who initiated the pile-on against Justine Sacco, the AIDS tweets woman. A little bit like how, when Randy Newman says when he dies, it's going to be Randy Newman who wrote the songs for Toy Story. And you just forget about the entire rest of his career. And I think when I die, for a lot of people, it's just going to be the Justine Sacco story. But anyway, I asked him how it felt to have started this pylon, like the first great internet pylon. And he said it felt delicious. And then he said, but I'm sure she's fine now. And that line really stayed with me. Like, of course he wants to think that, because we want to hurt people and not feel bad about it. But he was being deliberately incurious about the consequences of his actions, because we don't want to think that what we do, especially on the internet, has ripples. And that was the moment when I thought, I think I want to start telling ripple effect stories, because I want to remind people that there are consequences to everything that we do.
That book was really poignant, and one of the interesting things about that book is it made me think a lot, because obviously I'm in the public eye, and I get people wanting to cancel me constantly they just want to have a go at me for something I've said. I have to watch every word I said, and it was becoming more apparent, and that book came out, and we were all, as TV presenters, terrified of going on air every week, I read Glenn Hoddle's book the other day, John, and he talks about the Eileen Drury thing. And that was just one interview with a journalist who kept asking him about how he felt. Now, he says in the book, I mean, you have to read the book really to get the whole gist of it.
And I've forgotten, I remember there was a big scandal enveloping Glenn Hoddle, but I can't actually remember what it was.
So he said that, or it was reported that he said that if you were disabled, it meant that you were being punished for a previous life.
That's right.
What he says in his book is he sort of believes in reincarnation. It means you choose your life. So you can choose to come back as John Ronson, or you can choose to come back as Pele, or a great footballer or a musician, or you can choose to come back. I think this is the point he was making. I must say, could you read the book and not quote me on this if you're listening to this? But I think he says you can choose your route, your journey through the next world. But the guy was interviewing about football. So it all got misconstrued. And it, what the my takeaway from that is I immediately wanted to know what happened to the journalist who did that story, because he completely ruined Glenn Hoddle's life for that period of time and ruined. He was, you know, an England manager. He loved it. And, you know, he took the story, ran with it to get a few quid to pay for his bills, but completely ruined another man's life. And Glenn Hoddle said he was misquoted constantly in it.
Right. Yeah, it's really sad. I noticed it the other day. I was, I saw Variety. Everyone's toppling to clickbait these days. Like Variety, which is, you know, one of the Hollywood trade magazines, was never needed to be clickbaity. I guess because journalism is under such attack, people just feel the need to be more and more tabloidy and clickbaity. And the other day there was a headline, Kristen Stewart. What does Kristen Stewart think about the possibility of her winning an Oscar? I don't give a shit. Now, like, I didn't read the full article, but I did read all the comments saying clickbait, clickbait, clickbait. It's always just very dispiriting. It's controlling. It's a form of identity theft, isn't it? When a journalist decides that they're going to turn the subject into whatever they want them to be, like whatever the ingredient of their story, like the paint in their palette. And it's very, it's controlling, it's manipulative, and it's just kind of, and it's incurious, and also it's kind of lazy. And I'm not, you know, like we've all done it. Like, I'm not saying I'm not positioning myself as Gandhi here. Like when I was younger and more immature, you know, I'd have done that a little bit, sort of define people by their maddest edges. But I can tell you, it's so much more, it's just so much more satisfying and likable for the audience too, and just kinder and better and more moral, just better in every way, to portray the people that we're chronicling as complicated, nuanced human beings. And when you decide not to, you know, construct the story of good and evil, good and bad, when you throw that away and spend a little bit of extra time thinking about ways to construct the story in a more nuanced way, it's good for everyone. Everyone loves it.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. I was writing a column, a football column for a tabloid paper once, and I kind of agreed to leave. I might have been fired or agreed to leave. I'm not really sure, but they wanted it to be black and white. And I said, it's not black and white. And they said, yeah, but we get more followers. More clicks, more links. If it's black and white, sack them. And I went, I don't want to call for a man to be sacked from his job. I mean, like, I don't want that on my conscience. You know, I got values. And they were like, but you know, I think I was talking about the England manager at the time. I can't remember who it was. And they were going, call for him to be sacked. I was like, no, but it turned out that the industry, the journalism industry, look, there's some brilliant journalists out there, but it turned out that one of the ways that you could survive it and make money was by being a columnist. And basically you could become a troll. So you could just troll celebrities constantly, say how horrific they were. And Paris Hilton. Yeah, he started like that, didn't he?
And then
Hilton. Yeah, he started like that. And then he suddenly grew a conscience and went, oh no, and completely did an about turn and started befriending them, didn't he? I mean, I don't really follow his career, but I
know that he's expressed remorse, but that's all. Like that's enough. That's all that I know about Paris Hilton. But yeah, Piers Morgan, Katie Hopkins, that whole crowd, and you sort of get the sense they don't even really mean it. I always have a little bit more time for Piers Morgan because at least he admits, at least he eventually sometimes admits when he's been wrong, which is what other people don't do. But it doesn't seem like he necessarily really learns from when he was wrong.
He's very smart, Piers, and he's very well read, and he knows a lot. I think every time he talks about something, he makes sure he learns a lot about it prior to doing it. But at the same time though,
he's I think he's part of that sort of bear baiting world.
It's becoming, though. I think it was Denzel Washington who said that it used to be the most accurate, now it's the quickest and most sensational.
Yes. And oh God, we sound like two old fuckers talking about what's wrong with the world. But yeah, curiosity. One of the big things that frightened me when I saw how social media was beginning to change was how curiosity was becoming considered to be a weakness. Like patience was being considered a weakness. So what you would see is some shaming unfold, some big shaming unfold. And if somebody says, can we not just wait to hear what this person has to say for themselves, then that person would then be piled in on. We don't need to wait to hear what that person has to say. We know what they're like. That sort of Miss Marple-ish certainty that you could define somebody entirely by some poor phraseology in a tweet when you know absolutely nothing else about that person. And anybody saying, can we not just wait a minute for her plane to land so she could explain what she meant by the tweets or whatever. That person, there has been a danger that that person would then be piled in on. So, you know, there was a war on patience and curiosity on social media, and still is to an extent.
Yeah, and John, also, you talked about remorse briefly there. In the first episode of your podcast, it's really nice to hear the son of the evangelist. Sorry, I can't remember all their names. I'm so bad with names. But the son who's spent however many years now trying to say what I made was rubbish because he feels so remorseful about it.
If somebody listening to this is thinking about doing something bad, I think it's a good idea. One good reason to not do something bad is that you will, you know, just read some Dostoevsky. It will come back. You will be haunted. Unless you're a psychopath, you'll be haunted. You may not be haunted now, but you'll be haunted by the time you get to your 40s or 50s. So it's best, and you can't undo it. And it's best then to not do the bad thing.
But I wonder if it is bad. I mean, as I say, your investigation. I read a book once, and I think you've read it because I think you gave a book, you know, like one of those things, recommendations on it. But it was Ashley, what's her name? Dottie Charles.
Yeah, I thought she was great. That's such a good writer.
The one thing she did about that book, which was outrage, the bit which really hit me, basically she started this book because there'd been an outrage about a company putting a monkey on, Dottie's black, by the way, and they put a monkey on a logo or something. And I actually can't remember the whole fact, but basically everyone got outraged by it, and the brand got, the actual thing had to be taken off the shelves. And she was looking at going, what, where have we got to with this? So she went into her investigation. The one thing that really struck me from her book, which I really liked, was she says that when you pick a side on something, you're wearing it like a badge. So when we were kids, John, we were wearing our specials badges or the jam or whatever, and we're saying, this is me, this is us. She was saying, and I thought this was really quite acute and accurate, because you know for a fact, if you put up any form of banner saying I support this, it's doing nothing, because you're not raising any money, you're not putting boots on the streets, you're doing nothing.
Yeah, it's performative. Like, I hate the phrase virtual signaling, because it's a pejorative phrase which mocks. I also hate the phrase woke for the same reason, because it's, you know, woke is a phrase that comes from the black community and is now used to mock people who believe in things. And I feel the same way about virtue signaling, but that doesn't mean to say that virtue signaling doesn't exist and isn't a problem. It does, and it is. And I guess that's what Dottie's saying.
But I wonder if it's always been around, because when we were kids, you would have everyone with their C&D badges or their anti-racism badges or the right coloured laces in their Dr. Martens to show what they were supporting. And I wonder if that was a form of virtual signalling when we were kids.
I suppose it was. Well, it's definitely a form of identity politics. And by the way, you got it right. Like, I was wearing the specials badges.
Yeah.
I had a whole set of two-tone badges.
Do you know what? If we can just divert very slightly, because I am a massive specials fan, and I've become quite good friends with the band over the years, which makes me truly happy because I loved it. But I keep on, like, I'm actually looking at a poster of the specials here in the room. It's the album cover to the first album. And I always think how astonishing it is that they've lined up with black and white people together in a band. And we were listening to a combination of ska music mixed with punk, which produced the two-tone sound. And then there was the selector and everything else which came with it. And how all these years later, we're still not there. It's mental.
I know, right? Yeah, Joe Strummer talks about that, about why he put reggae influences into The Clash. He said because he would walk under the Westway in West London, and out of one club would come punk music, out of the next club would come reggae music. So for him, you know, this music all combined in the air under the Westway. And yeah, I thought that was good. I have a specials story. Would you like to hear it?
I'd love to, yeah, of course.
Okay, I've told it, I think, like once before, so it's not the first time I've ever told it, maybe twice. It was 1979, so I would have been 12 years old. For some reason, my permissive mother just dropped me off at Sophia Gardens in Cardiff on my own to see the specials. Wow. At the age of 12. And I went in, and I got to the front, and I had a brainwave. I thought, if I pretend to faint, maybe they'll lift me over the barrier and let me stand on the side of the stage and I could watch the show from then. And I had a camera with me. I was a very bad photographer, but I had a camera with me. So I did. I pretended to faint. This was before the band came on. And I got lifted over the barrier and side of the stage and sitting there. Terry Hall comes up to me and says, are you okay? And I was like worried, like, oh my God, am I going to, is he going to like kick me out? And I said, are you in the specials? And he said, I'm the singer. And I was like, okay. And he said, no, it's fine, just stay here. So he was really nice to me. And he was like making sure I was okay. Came up to me a few times, asked if I was okay. Jerry Dammers posed for me. I took photos of Jerry Dammers and I watched the whole gig, like Alice Through the Looking Glass on the side of the stage, because the specials allowed it.
That is amazing.
Isn't that amazing? And it was really, it was a big moment for me, actually. Like, there's life beyond, you know, there's a world going on out there that isn't just the suburbs of Cardiff.
Do you know
what? It was a big moment. Like, me,
really?
You know, me, yeah, yeah. I went through the Looking Glass and the people who I met there were delightful.
That's amazing. I always thought, when you look back at the early special stuff from 1979, you always see, like, all the crowds getting up onto the stage, and it's so unbelievable to watch now, the idea of health and safety, and like Terry's still right. Singing, and he's got all these skinheads like moon stomping around him and everything else, and it's just beautiful moments, I think, you know. And I was fascinated the other day listening to I was talking to Simon Halfon, who did the Supersonic Oasis gig, and he said something very astute on a podcast I did with him. I'm not sure whether it'd be out before this one or after this one, but he was saying that Oasis Nebworth gig, it possibly is the last major gig, and they, I think they say it on the documentary, I think Noel says it as well, where everybody's there without a mobile phone and they're not connected. They're actually showing attention to the band on the stage in front of them rather than looking at it through a phone. And I thought that was a really interesting observation, because we are all so connected now, which is what's creating the culture wars, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, social media certainly doesn't help, and was designed to create a world of division and outrage.
Do you think? I thought it was to bring us all together.
No, it wasn't. So there was a utopian ideal behind the creation of the internet, but it was a libertarian ideal of unencumbered free speech. So with no restriction, machines, the utopians who invented the internet were engineers at Stanford University in Silicon Valley. Stanford was at the heart of Silicon Valley, so I can't remember the phrase, that your town and gown, that's what they called it. You'd learn like computer science or whatever at Stanford, and then you'd be headhunted by a company that was probably just a couple of miles away from Stanford to work in the computer industry. So in the late 80s, it was really Stanford. It was the professors and the students at Stanford who were inventing the internet. And they were all libertarians. They were libertarians, and engineers, which basically meant don't stop the machine. Like, the machine will do what the machine is capable of doing, and we must not interfere in any way. And that's the internet that we've been living in ever since, where when there were early attempts to deal with offensive material, the libertarians just yelled like no. And so there were never any, there was no, I talk about this, by the way, in episode 5 of Things
Okay,
like
brilliant,
that.
Excellent.
Because I found the very first person ever to be publicly shamed because of something they did online. That's what happened. The libertarian engineers were like, this is not going to stop. You know, okay, you know, this is a conflict incident. Somebody told a joke that's went down badly and people are calling for this joke to be banned. But no, the machine cannot be stopped. So we've been living in that world ever since. And pretty quickly, these libertarian utopians realized that unstoppable, unencumbered free speech is really profitable because what it leads to is outrage and people stay online longer than they would if they weren't outraged. So it was very profitable for the tech companies and it was deliberate. We've all been, imagine going to a party, imagine going to like a libertarian party where everybody like shoots their guns into the ceiling whenever they want to and comes up to you and says something incredibly offensive to your face and just lies to you. You know, this is we've been in this party for the last, since the late 80s.
Well, it's actually really funny because I was having this conversation the other day with one of my friends and we were talking about the print industry, how that, look, obviously I'm not a historian, but as I understand it, when the print industry happened, I think 1400 something, suddenly it meant they could get a lot more propaganda out there. It was bad for the Catholics, as I understand it. Protestant propaganda was very powerful and it caused, according to some historians, multiple deaths. Now, you go back to let's go back to our childhood and we're going to a football match. You turn up at Stamford Bridge and you walk up the Fulham Road. It's so hysterical to think about it now. But you had all the skinheads there trying to push propaganda on you. They were trying to sell the British Bulldog, which was the National Front newspaper. There was fanzines. There was like lots and lots of posters and stuff and badges they were giving out, which all had National Front British movement connotations on them. If you listen to Don Letts, actually, he did a great documentary called Skinhead, and they tracked down the early people like you would do on one of your documentaries, who said it was so easy to convert young men. You had to just say, they're coming over here, taking our jobs, da-da-da-da-da, you know, usual sort of stuff. And people were doing it. So Stamford Bridge, you know, West Ham, all those grounds where they used to do it. And then you'd have the guy with the CND staff. And then you get the anti-Nazi guy and you're thinking, Jesus, you're brave. Do you know what I mean? It's like, right. You know, and they were there all vying for your attention as you just walked to Stamford Bridge and it was coming at you. Now that's the internet, isn't it? But you're sitting in your house and it's all coming at you, all the stuff, you know, Black Lives Matters, you know, they're coming over here and stealing our jobs. Migrants are coming, da, 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 da. It's all coming at you constantly.
Yeah, it really is. And you're in bubbles too, you're in your echo chambers too, which skews the way you deal with it. You're not looking into their faces, which skews the way that you deal with it. And look what's happening. It's people are going insane. The reason why I wanted to make Things Fell Apart was because I was sitting behind my computer watching friends and former friends lose their minds. Because they were becoming too embroiled in the culture wars. It was impacting them. And this isn't me making a value judgment on whether the actual conflict itself is something worth fighting for, but it was having an extremely dramatic, disproportionate response to their mental health. Mm-hmm. Our people were losing their reputations and their families and so on. And that's why I wanted to make the show.
Well, it's really interesting you say that. I've got a friend who's become an anti-vax, but he's gone so far into it, and you know, he might be true the stuff he says, but he's gone so far down it that he genuinely believes that the government are putting stuff into us to control us. And I'm like, okay, I can get the idea that you don't like us putting a vaccine in us, but the idea we're being controlled by, but he's gone that far and he's got quite a big job, and I'm worried about him losing it. Meanwhile, my daughter's going back to right at the beginning of our podcast, they're at university, they're 19, and they are getting so obsessed with American politics. Like, it's, they're living it all the time. I'm like, and I said to them once, you do know we don't live in America, because it is a bit different. And they go, but have you heard about the discrepancy between this and that? And I went, that's in America, right? And it's like, yeah, what's it like over here? And they go, I don't know, but in America it's, and I'm like, why do you care? They were so anti-Trump. And it was like, yeah, I get it. So am I, but so, you know.
Yeah, something happened to us. I mean, this is maybe for another podcast, but something happened to us when Trump was elected. And I very much include myself in this. You know, it felt like 9/11 had happened again. It felt like, in one respect, that the future suddenly became very uncertain. That's what I mean by the 9/11 analogy. Obviously, Trump getting elected was very different to 9/11 in lots of other ways. But on both occasions, you felt like the rug had been pulled out from under you and the future was very uncertain and you were entering a frightening, uncertain new age. And I watched CNN nonstop for 4 years. I've watched Anderson Cooper every night for 4 years. And he was telling me exactly what I wanted to hear, which was that Trump was just terrible. It was just a constant danger. Like you had to be on constant high alert. Now, I should say that to a large extent, I still think that's true. I do think Trump was really trying to and would destroy democracy given the chance and may still do it. I still think Trump's a very dangerous person, but I also regret that I was, like a lot of people, I went too far into my corner. And when Trump got re-elected, when Trump was almost re-elected in 2020, that came as an enormous surprise, It's like if you watch CNN for the last 4 years, you just spent the whole 4 years thinking, well, everybody in America now realizes it's been a terrible mistake. And besides a tiny number of crazy Americans, whoever stands against Trump is going to win in a landslide. And the fact is, Trump did really well in 2020. And I resent CNN for not giving me any indication of that. And I also resent CNN for telling stories in very biased ways. You know, before Trump was elected, so quite a long time ago, I was giving an interview here in America, and I was comparing the lies of the right-wing media, like InfoWars, to when our media, the kind of mainstream liberal media, is like biased or tells just a version of the story. They're not telling outright lies, but they're leaving stuff out to make the story a little bit better. And I said, you know, there's many different ways to lie. And the person who I gave that interview to then gave an interview to the Columbia Journalism Review, where she said that what I just said made her feel uncomfortable. And that made me so annoyed because I thought, no, you know what? I'm actually right here. There are many different ways to lie. And let's not be so smug on the left that we won't even look inward at the mistakes that our media makes. And the Trump years, I think, really bear that out. There's many occasions during the Trump years where I think CNN viewers don't even know that we were told something that wasn't true. I can give you examples. But by and large, you know, I think something changed in us when Trump was elected. And to a very large extent, our concerns and our paranoias are justified, because I think Trump is a truly terrible person who will destroy everything, because that's how deep his narcissism goes. But we got too trapped in our own echo chamber.
It's funny because you I follow you on social media, and you were constantly asked, because you'd written the psychopath test book, whether Trump was a psychopath, narcissist, or whatever. You were constantly being asked to comment on that, and also you are constantly being asked to comment on people being cancelled, on they've been shamed. So you've been what's your book called?
You've been publicly shamed.
Publicly shamed. That's it. I love that book. Love it so much. I can't remember the title. No, I do love it though, John. And you keep on getting asked. Do you mind being the person they come to for these things?
I got a little annoyed about becoming like, as my friend John Safran, the great Australian journalist, said once, that I'd become like a shaming imam. Like I sort of, And that, it did bug me for a while, because once Even Publicly Shamed came out, people who were very, like, keen shamers who didn't want to hear my message did a bit of an all-out assault on me.
Yeah.
And I became like a little bit of a meme, like I was the pearl clutcher. Yeah. And so that put me in a grumpy mood. And I sort of wanted to get away from the whole sort of shaming conversation for a few years.
Yeah.
And so I did. Which I sort of, I'm still quite glad about, because I don't know, if all we had done, I think it's quite dangerous for journalists to be stuck in one subject matter.
Yeah.
Especially this subject matter, because what happens is the left just scream at you. And so you double down. And I've seen loads of people in the centre move further to the right in the last few years.
Right.
Because the left, you know, because the left are like so sort of can be so kind of hectoring and authoritarian. And I just didn't want to be in that world. So when I decided to make a show about the culture wars, things fell apart. My first rule to myself was, this show won't be a part of the culture wars. Mm. I want to diffuse things. I want to be like gentle and humanistic. And I want to make a show about the culture wars that doesn't become a part of the culture wars. Mm. And it was kind of for that reason. Like I it's very easy to become part of the culture wars and you're just fighting battles all the time. And you become a meme, you get typecast, you typecast yourself, you double down, you become more of a caricature, you move further to the right. Like, I could see a version of my future, you know, panning out that way. And I was like, no, that's not what I want.
What I love about you said earlier is the idea that you're sitting watching CNN. I said to my friends constantly, I keep going online, and I'm going to use this word, it's the wrong word, but I keep on getting radicalized with things to do with, especially the pandemic. You know, we should be locking down. We shouldn't be locking down. We should be, you know, it's like, I keep getting like these things. And I found that it was really, I wasn't being able to take a measured view on it. And again, going back to why I love the stuff you do, is it's always measured. And I love it, because you can think, okay, you're really giving me a good, you know, a really lovely rounded view of what's happened, rather than I'm on the left, I'm on the right, this is how I feel about it. And I love that, because it's getting more and more scarce, isn't it? Don't you think?
It is. And although I wonder whether things are going to move in a different direction, I can't help thinking. I speak to a lot of parents of kids who are like 12, 13, and I always ask them, you know, what are your kids, how are your kids dealing with all of this? Because I have a theory that the younger generation, the kids who are now around the ages of 12 or 13, will want a more relaxed life and won't want to live under the strict conditions that their older siblings have placed upon themselves and on the world, where you can be punished in adulthood for a mistake that you made in childhood, for instance. Like, these are untenable. And why do we want to set such strict rules for ourselves? Now, I'm not saying in any way that, like, so I want people to feel free to be offensive again, because I don't. But I do think that we are creating a set, you know, that a new generation is creating a set of rules for itself that are so strict they're finding it impossible to live under. Like you like judging people by some poor phraseology in a tweet or whatever. And so I wonder whether a younger generation are going to come along and just be a little bit looser, in the same way that third wave feminism came along in the 90s. And I look at this later on in the show. And third wave feminists were more sex positive than second wave feminists were. Second wave feminists were very anti-porn, anti-playboy. Third wave feminists were, like, you know, pro-porn, obviously certain, you know, by which I mean kind of consensual porn, pro, you know, sex positive and so on. And I wonder whether something's going to happen similarly in the whole quote unquote cancel culture world in the coming years, that a new generation's going to come along and is going to create a set of rules that aren't quite so strict.
My favorite saying I always say to everyone always is, nothing ever happens until it does. Because in my lifetime, you know, I'm similar age to you, we've just watched things happen which have just been incredible. And what should, you know, like Trump becoming like that guy who Barack Obama took the mickey out of, ended up being president of America. But you then, what's an interesting thing is my friend works in fashion. And I said, how are you getting on at the moment? He said, we're having a hard time. And I said, why is that? He goes, because the young people are really the real fashion. Young people have all turned their back on sustainable fashion. And he's part of that world. They want secondhand clothes. Not only that, because secondhand clothes are so, I mean, my daughters sort of grew up in between me and North London. They were part of the trendy North London set. So they've been wearing secondhand clothes constantly for the last 4 years. It's really filtered down to everyone now. But because they're wearing secondhand clothes, they all look different. And now if you want to buy new clothes, you want to buy new clothes, which doesn't look the same as everybody else. So he's saying we're having a nightmare because we've got to do shorter runs of everything as well, because people, and I thought that is brilliant. That's a really interesting. So you're right. The younger generation come along, look at the older generation, go, I don't want to do that. I want to do what I want to do.
As was always the case. Like I think about things. It's funny, actually. I think about things that I really hated when I was a kid. I think about this quite a lot. I think, you know what, a lot of the things that I hated when I was a kid must have been a sort of common consensus of people of my age, because a lot of those things don't exist anymore. So Saturday night television in the 1970s and 80s could be very, you know, it was very anti-gay, very homophobic, lots of jokes about immigrants. And I remember sitting there watching like the comedians on ITV, sitting in Cardiff when I was a kid, just scowling, looking at these old blokes, you know, telling these cruel jokes about black people.
Well, the one that I think's really interesting for that is, and I talked to Richard Coles about this. Do you know him? He's the guy who's now
he's in the communards.
He's now a vicar, and I interviewed him on this podcast, and I said, how on earth can you be a vicar? Because when I grew up, I still have a real problem with religion, because they were at odds with, you know, obviously we grew up in the 80s and 90s or 70s through to 80s or whatever. And during that period of time, there was a lot of, you know, we had Boy George come along, we had Frankie Goes to Hollywood, we had all these things, and being gay was good and it was all right. You know, there was obviously a lot of pushback at the time, but we were supporting it, but the church didn't. So they were my enemy. And it's very hard to then, because I don't have a religion, so apologies to anyone with their religion. So it's very hard for me to then suddenly go, hey, I love the Church of England again now, because they were so anti the culture that I was growing up in. So it's really strange how you take it with you. And so I've always had, and I said to him, how do you square it off? And he went, no, it's fine and all that. But, you know, he was a guy who was clearly hated by his religion at one stage, because that's what they did back in the 80s, the 70s and 80s, didn't they? Which is what you make, the point you make in your...
In episode three with Steve Peters. Yeah, absolutely. I know. So I think each generation does come on and wants to better the generation that came before. So I suppose the big question is now, will the new generation come along and want to better their older siblings by being more radical? Although I don't quite know how that could possibly happen. Or significantly less radical. And more party-ish. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
It's interesting. I'm conscious that I'm taking up too much of your time, but I just want to touch on this because it's interesting, because we are getting more and more connected. The one thing that I noticed through the pandemic was how we were very quickly, not only have we got different values, obviously, some of us, we were very quick to turn on our neighbours when we suddenly were told to lock down, and people were going, reporting their neighbours for standing in the driveway or going for too many walks. And I've seen them in China this week. They've released a new app where you can see within a 500 metre radius if somebody's been in debt, because that is what they value as being poor over there. So the it's called China Daily state-run newspaper reported, it's called the Map of Deadbeat Debtors. But there's already been 6,000 people in China who failed to pay their taxes or misbehaved on public transport, and they've been barred from taking planes or trains in and out of the country because they've been in some sort of debt. we're getting to this stage where we're going to have even more information about each other. And even, so I don't think the culture wars will be going away very soon because we're very judgy, aren't we?
Well, when you were sending that story, I was reminded when I wrote So You've Been Publicly Shamed, I decided to, you know, people say, oh my God, Twitter's becoming like the Stasi. So I thought, well, let me look into the Stasi. Like, I want to find out more about the Stasi. So the Stasi, for people who don't know, were the East German secret police in the 1980s that were making sure that there were, like, you know, capitalists in their midst. And they were famous for, they had all these experiments, like they'd collect smells. They'd go into people's house and try and collect their smells. and they had like all of these, there were Stasi officers standing on street corners communicating to other Stasi officers by scratching their nose or, you know, putting their finger in their ears, like the strange dance of arm movements. Anyway, a Stasi psychologist back in the 80s was tasked with trying to find out why there were so many willing informants. People weren't forced to become Stasi informants, and also they weren't paid. So why were there so many willing informants? And the conclusion that this Stasi psychologist came to was that people just wanted to make sure that their neighbours were doing the right thing. So when we look back at the Stasi and think, God, those people were crazy, just remember that we are the Stasi now.
Do you think we're... I was listening to a thing on Native Americans the other day, a podcast, and they used to live in communities of 25 to 30, maybe four or five families all together. And then if you married into another family as the man, you would move to the woman's family and live with them. But they sort of identified as a bigger tribe sometimes, but they would live in small communities because that's the best way of doing it. We now are in a, you know, I've got, I don't know, 600,000 followers or something, 700,000 on Twitter or something, and 100,000 on Instagram, but people I don't know, you know, am I supposed to be communicating? And then I've got on TV where I've got, you know, hundreds of thousands, over a million on that thing. Yeah. Are we supposed to be communicating with that many people? And I wonder if we are, you know, in society. Mm.
It is a lot. I mean, from personal experience, I should say that if I'm giving a talk and there's 400 people in the room, I feel a lot more comfortable than if I'm giving a talk and there's 1,000 people in the room. So maybe there is a limit for our personal comfort.
Right.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But then again, you know, what about Robbie Williams playing the stadiums? Although actually that's evidence in support too, because, you know, the first time I visited Robbie Williams in the house he was living at the time, he said to me, you know, the reason why I chose this house, because it was a pretty big, like it was a sort of Beverly Hills house, but it was a little, I felt, disappointingly modest. Like, I'd never been to a Beverly Hills mansion before. And I thought, oh, you know, so I'll have to, this will be incredibly exciting. I'm going to go and visit Robbie Williams and it's incredibly exciting. But it was surprisingly modest. Not anymore. Now he lives in fucking Versailles. But at the time it was quite modest. And I asked him why. And he said, I wanted a house where all the rooms were small. And I thought about that, and I thought, that's because you play stadiums, right?
Right, okay.
When you're home, you want to feel sort of cozy and protected. Yeah, so there you go. Maybe playing stadiums, unless you're a very particular sort of person, is a kind of traumatizing experience.
I wonder if we're all just in such a mess now. We want to control everything around us, and so that's why we need you to think like us. We need you, you know. And there's so much confirmation bias out there. In episode two, even when you say to that you know the woman that the words didn't actually mean what she thought, she refused to believe you.
Yeah,
Confirmation
bias is everywhere. In fact, here's my great confirmation bias joke, which I'd say probably 5% of your listeners are about to find hilarious. ever since I first learned about confirmation bias, I've been seeing it everywhere.
Okay, I get it.
That's actually, you know what? That joke kills at psychology conferences.
All right, John, listen, I've taken up too much of your time. Just finally, what are you doing next? Have you got any plans you're going to be doing? I love that talk you did, by the way, when you did the psychopath. You were talking about narcissists, and that was brilliant when I went to see you do that. Yeah. Any more of those sort of things?
Yeah, you know what? Yes, I'm going to come over at the end of March. So for the probably the last week of March and the first week of April, I am going to do some shows based on Things Fell Apart. I've decided to do them in small places. With Psychopath Night, my show based on the book, The Psychopath Test.
Yeah.
By the end of doing that show, we were playing big concert halls. And I don't know, I didn't want to do that again. So I'm playing really small places, like 300, 400 seats. Pretty short run. I'll do some in London, some in Cardiff, some in Sheffield. And I haven't written the show yet, but I really love the fact that people really like Things Fell Apart in Britain. So I'm going to write a show based on the podcast, and I'm going to bring it to Britain.
Perfect. Well, if you're listening to this, I would recommend going to that because I saw his last show and it was fantastic. Real, it gets you thinking. That's what I like about your work, John. Really gets you thinking. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Tim, it was a delight to talk to you again. By the way, I did a big thing with Scarlett Moffat recently, and the only time I ever met her in person was on your show, was on Sunday Brunch. I have lots of good memories of Sunday Brunch. That meeting Scarlett Moffat, getting drunk with Guy Garvey of Elbow on the cocktails that you make at the end of the show. And I remember whispering to Guy Garvey, I'm drunk on Channel 4.
Guy Garvey was literally on last week, which is fantastic.
Oh, amazing.
Well, I do love that when everybody, you bring together so many different guests and everybody just seems to enjoy themselves because, you know, everyone's there for a reason. They've done something and it's always
It was really fun. I met Phil Collins on Sunday Brunch and ended up, you know, sort of knowing him a little bit. Not much, but a little bit.
What did you make of Phil? Because I was blown away by him. I just thought he was such a lovely man. For all his success, he was just so down to earth, wasn't he? Just such a lovely bloke.
Most of them are, right?
Yeah, they are. Yeah, it's true.
I've met really, really famous people, they have all been... maybe not all, but the majority of them have been like very thoughtfully considerate. People like George Clooney, who turned one of my books into a film, and Robbie Williams is another one, who go the extra mile to make you feel comfortable. I remember one time I had a sore throat, and I just mentioned to Robbie Williams, I've got a sore throat. And he went off for like 10 minutes and came back with some hauls for me.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that they do. They're well brought up, the very famous.
Good. John, thank you so much. Speak to you
soon. Thanks, Tim. It was a delight.